Since ancient Spanish legal tradition provided that members of the clergy could be tried only in courts staffed by fellow clerics, a solemn priest, born in Spain, was dispatched to Béjar, and he started his investigation not by examining the accused friar at Santa Teresa, but by moving through the little community and listening to whatever gossip the soldiers and the friars from the other missions wished to reveal. When he was finished, he had accumulated enough petty accusations against both friars to charge them with almost anything, and grimly he announced, "Tomorrow I shall examine the culprits." When the two friars stood before him, they made a poor impression, for they were not the neat, well-shaved clerics he was accustomed to on the streets of Zacatecas. Damian appeared in a faded, dusty blue habit, and Domingo's unkempt beard wandered over his chubby face. Ill-matched, Damian, tall, thin, and fiery-eyed, Domingo, short, fat, and marked by a silly grin. They should have stood in silence as he abused them, but to his astonishment, they showed every inclination to defend their actions. Fra Damian was particularly vigorous in his self-defense. "I have labored day and night to build this mission, to make it self-sufficient, to bring Indians into our fold. Some men might have accomplished more, but none could have worked more diligently in the service of our Lord and our King." "But did you allow the dancing?" the judge asked. "I did. I worked my Indians from dawn to dusk, and I thank God that Brother Domingo taught them to sing, for it made them better workers in God's cause." "Were you not ordered by the civil authority to stop the dancing?" "I was, and I did." "But was there not continued dancing at the mission's ranch?" "I'm told there was." "And did not your Fray Domingo join in the dancing?" "I'm told that he did." "Are you not responsible for what your friars do?" Fray Damian considered this probing question for some moments, standing erect, his eyes staring straight ahead, his hands clasped at his chest. It would be both easy and correct for him to claim that what happened at the distant ranch was beyond his control, but to deny his longtime companion would be worse than craven. It would be against the rule of the Franciscans. "I'm responsible." "If I were a vengeful man," the priest said, "I would add you to this indictment. You have failed miserably in your duty." "I demand that you include me," Damian said, and he took a step forward. "Stand where you are," the inquisitor ordered, his face reddening. But Damian kept moving forward until he reached the desk behind which his judge sat. Once there, he reached for a quill and would have inscribed his name on the indictment had not the priest knocked the quill away and bellowed, "Soldiers, arrest this man." So what had been intended as an orderly hearing ended in a general debacle, for as soon as Fray Domingo saw his protector dragged toward the exit door, he leaped at the guards and began pummeling them. A general melee ensued, in the midst of which the enraged priest shouted, "Chain them both!" In a tiny cell behind the presidio, no beds, no water, food only once a day, the two friars remained in manacles for 3 days, and when released, they had to promise both the priest and the captain that they would henceforth permit no Indian dancing. They had resumed their now somber duties when a convoy arrived from Saltillo with an unexpected member, a young officer bringing a commission that installed him as the new commander of the Presidio de Béjar and retired the former incumbent. As Damian came from the mission to greet the officer, he saw from a distance that the new man was Alvaro, and ran forward to embrace him. "Dearest brother, you are needed here." But before Alvaro could respond, Damian asked, How is Benita? Fine. If permission is given, she could be coming here. Fired by this hope, and supported by an understanding commander, Fray Damian launched what could be called the Golden Years of Santa Teresa. For with assistance from the soldiers, the walls of the mission were completed, its canal, and, most important, its adobe church. And at the ranch, Fray Domingo increased his herds until they taxed the ability of his Indians to control them. And the dancing resumed. If Fray Domingo had been required to pacify only the relatively amenable Indians at the ranch near Bejar, he would have succeeded. But the Franciscans had had the bad luck to place their missions on land which was more or less claimed by Indians of a much different type. The Apacharilla was not a specific land area, nor was it a highly organized brotherhood of tribes. The word represented a mystical concept, the region and union of the Apache. The imprecision was twofold. The specific territory was never defined, and membership was so elastic that any Apache tribe could be included or excluded as it preferred. One thing was certain. In recent decades, the Apache had come to consider the lands around Bejar as part of their Apacharilla, and evicting the white intruders became an obligation. Even so, a kind of truce might have been negotiable. Spaniards to the east, Apache to the west. Had not another warrior tribe of Indians invaded the western plains at about this time? The newcomers were the dreaded Comanche, horse Indians from the Rocky Mountain areas, who considered all other humans their enemies. Apache and Comanche, what a sadly mismatched pair. The former somewhat sedentary, the latter constantly roving. The former without many horses, the latter the finest horsemen of the plains. The former a loose confederation of many differing tribes, the latter fearfully concentrated, and both wanting to occupy the same lands. No Comanche had yet been seen at Bejar. They would not appear in force for nearly 50 years. But their unrelenting pressure on the western reaches of the Apacharilla meant that the Apache were forced to move eastward, and this brought them into conflict with the Spanish at Bejar. But for the time being, a kind of rude accommodation did exist, as proved by an enthusiastic report on conditions at the mission, submitted at this time. In 1729, an investigative priest from Zacatecas, whose name Espejo fortuitously meant glass, or as some said, spyglass, visited all parts of Tejas on an inspection tour. After dismal experiences in Nacogdoches and the coastal areas, he reached Bejar in an uncompromising mood. But here he saw how ably the Saldana brothers cooperated in governing the place. At the end of September 1729, I came at last to Mission Santa Teresa de Casafuerte de Colegio de Propaganda Fide de Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe de Zacatecas, and all the unpleasantness of preceding days vanished as if God had set down in the wilderness a great shining lantern. The mission was guarded by two exemplary friars, Damian de Saldana, of good family and superior orders, who manages all, and Domingo Pacheco, a mestizo of lower orders, who performs wonders with his Indians, of whom 234 Pampopa, Postito, and Tacame reside in the mission. About 3 Indians per year have been formally converted, the rest behaving as Christians, but not belonging to the church. The order of the day reflects the piety of Fray Damian. Church bell at sunrise, when all attend Mass. Copious breakfast for 45 minutes. Then everyone to work on the building projects supervised by Fray Damian, who is an outstanding builder. Lunch at noon, again well provided, and siesta for all. At 2 in the afternoon, return to work, and at 5, the church bell again, whereupon the entire population reports to the church to recite the Doctrina Christiana, which includes Way of the Cross, Lord's Prayer, Hail Mary, Apostles' Creed, Confiteor, Precepts of the Church, Seven Sacraments, Seasonal Points of Faith, and concluding with the Four Last Things. It is heartening to hear these Indians, who only a few years ago followed pagan beliefs about rocks and rivers, recite in unison the holy words that mean they are now approaching salvation. At meals, Fray Domingo served us with beef, mutton, cabrito, and chickens. He also provided squash, potatoes, watermelons, and lentils. From the carefully tended orchard, he had all the fruits of the season, including peaches, pears, and plums, with dried cherries. In obedience to the strict prohibition issued by our king in order to protect the industries of Spain, the mission grows no grapes or olives, although I believe each would prosper here were they allowed. Then Father Espejo listed in detail some 60 valuable items owned by the mission, divided into 5 categories, and samples from each will indicate the material progress Fray Damian had made. For the women, 1 loom, 3 spinning wheels, 4 scissors, 17 needles, 7 candle molds. For the men, 5 plowshares, 7 hoes, 5 scythes, 1 pair tongs, 7 shovels. For protection, 3 arquebuses, 5 pistols, 20 bullet molds, 6 swords. For the builders, 2 planes, 2 iron wedges, 5 sledgehammers, 67 iron nails. For God, 2 incense burners, 3 small bells, 5 sets of altar cloths. The report ended with 2 footnotes, the first displaying pride, the second confusion. This mission owns several treasures, a statue of San Antonio de Padua, carved in Zacatecas, and a set of 14 Stations of the Cross, painted on canvas in Spain. It also has 2 fine blue habits of linen and wool, plus 3 iron shovels, gifts from His Majesty the King. As to the charge so often voiced that the only Indians who ever convert are old people about to die, I confess that this is justified. Young braves refuse to give up their dancing and other favored abominations. But older warriors, as they approach death, listen attentively to Fray Damian's preaching. Soldiers at the Presidio sneer, "The friars catch only falling leaves." But I told them, 3 souls saved, even in extremis, are still 3 brands saved from the burning, and you should rejoice in their salvation. But the soldiers laughed, as young men will. In his summary paragraphs, he delivered his judgment as to this mission, saying in part, "Santa Teresa de Casafuerte, in its exemplary conduct and its fruitful relationship with its presidio, justifies in unmatched perfection the accepted Spanish theory of governing new provinces, to Christianize, to civilize, to utilize. I can foresee only continued blessings for Béjar, and as soon as I return to Zacatecas, I shall recommend to the Council of the Indies that civilian settlers from Spain be brought here to establish the city which shall complement this fine venture." In a separate memorandum, which he discussed with neither of the Saldañas, Espejo proposed an idea that would bring great happiness to each of the brothers. Béjar is now so firmly established, even though its population is minimal, that the time has come when more wives ought to be encouraged to join their husbands at the presidio. This will give the Indians and mestizos a taste of true Spanish civilization, which can only edify them. I therefore propose that Benita Liñán de Saldaña be allowed and encouraged to move with her 3 sons to Béjar immediately. I know this lady. She is a splendid example of Spanish womanhood at its best, and will add honor to the presidio. The proposal was quickly adopted by the military in Zacatecas, and one morning in December 1729, a soldier posting in from the Rio Grande shouted at the gates of the Presidio, "We come bringing great treasure." And he caused so much excitement that Fray Damian was summoned from his mission labors and was present when a mule train came up to the Presidio bearing Benita. When she stepped down, dust-covered, Damian gasped, for at 25 and the mother of three rambunctious sons, she was far more beautiful than before. Throwing her arms wide, as if to embrace the entire wilderness, she cried, "I am so glad to be here." Brushing aside the soldiers who tried to help with her children, she ran first to her husband, kissing him ardently and displaying their sons. Then she turned, saw Damian waiting beside the wall, and ran to him, throwing her arms about him and kissing him on the cheek. "Brother Damian, I am honored of God to be allowed to share in your work. These are your nephews." The next year was a period of some confusion for Fray Damian. He dined frequently at the Presidio, once such an alien and unfriendly place, and there he saw how well Benita had raised her sons. He found many other excuses for visiting, and was invariably heartened by her continued liveliness, though he would never admit, even to himself, why he kept going there. In his quiet, austere way, he was in love. And sometimes when he labored on some new mission structure, he felt a deep hunger to see her again, to satisfy himself that she was there, and to appreciate the fact that she was a woman, totally different from himself, and wonderful in her unique way. Seeing her, listening to her charming manner with her sons was enough, he thought, and in a subtle act of self-deception, he began to convince himself that he visited only to help her with her eldest boy, Ramon, now 7. That one, Benita, he'd make a fine priest. "How foolish! He's a rowdy little boy who hates to sit still while you say prayers. He has no sense of vocation and little likelihood of ever attaining one." Damian ignored this sensible assessment and continued visiting the boy, but with no constructive results. When Alvaro said one day, "I do not like the idea of your Fray Domingo spending so much time at the ranch," Damian assured his brother that much good work was being done there with cattle and goats and sheep. But Alvaro's apprehension focused on other matters. "It's the Apache. They keep moving closer, and sooner or later I fear they'll try to attack the ranch." Again, Damian protested. "Domingo has the touch of God. He saves souls, and given time, he'll bring peace even to the Apache." Alvaro grew quite serious. "You don't seem to understand. With three walled missions here at Béjar, with his stout presidio, with the armed huts in the village, I'm still afraid the Apache will attack one night. Imagine what they might do at an unprotected ranch." "God ordered us to establish that ranch," Damian said. "He will protect it." "I hope so, because I won't be able to." Some days later, when Domingo had returned to the mission, Damian accompanied him to the Presidio, where the three leaders consulted. The fat little friar trying to convince Captain Alvaro that life at the ranch was safe. Each week, the Apache understand a little better what Christianity means and the salvation it will bring them. "Are they living at the ranch? Real converts, I mean?" "No, but they do come in now and then, and I talk with them." Alvaro stood up and saluted. "You're a brave man, Domingo, much braver than I, and may God protect you." "I dance with them, I sing with them, I pray with them, and that's the pathway to salvation." Faithful to his promise, Father Espejo did forward his urgent appeal to the king, begging him to send civilian settlers to Béjar. But before any response was possible, the growing town was tripled in size by an extraordinary event. In early 1731, three faltering missions wasting away in the north were transferred to San Antonio de Béjar, where they joined the three already in operation. Of course, the buildings themselves were not transported. They were so forlorn and storm-shattered they could not have been moved. But the six friars and the best of their Indian helpers made long treks through Tejas, expressing robust satisfaction when they saw the vastly improved site they were to occupy. "How beautiful their names are," Fray Damian thought as he helped the three new missions select their locations. Nuestra Señora de la Purísima Concepción, San Juan Capistrano, San Francisco de la Espada. Like shining beads on a rosary. When they were in place, the first two on the eastern bank of the river, like the earliest mission, San Antonio de Valero, the third on the western bank, like Santa Teresa and San Jose. Damian warned the new friars, "Your success will depend on two things, prayers to help you do better at converting Indians than we've done, and securing an assured water supply for the fields that will feed you and your Indians." The incoming friars encouraged Fray Damian to tell them more about bringing water onto their land, and they were so persistent in seeking his advice that he ended by laying out the three additional ditches, which would in future years account for much of Béjar's growth. Having shown the newcomers how to survey so as to avoid costly aqueducts unless they were inescapable, he continued to counsel the friars until work actually started. Then found himself once more with a shovel, demonstrating how the digging should be done. Fray Damian was 45 years old when the new missions started functioning. Rather tired and increasingly emaciated in appearance, but he was so eager to help these servants of God get started correctly that he labored on their ditches as if he were a member of their missions, and when at last the precious water began to flow, he felt as if he had helped write a small addition to the Acts of the Apostles. There was at San Juan Capistrano the mission which honored a saintly man who had worked among the Bulgarians in much the way that Damian worked with the Indians, a young mestizo friar named Eusebio, who because of his extreme sanctity had been allowed to take major orders. And he was so awed by this privilege that he honored with extra seriousness each precept of the Franciscans. Particularly, he wore about his waist the long, heavily knotted cord that served a double purpose. It was a belt, holding the blue habit close to the body, but also a flagellum, a scourge to be applied whenever one felt he was indulging in vainglory. Sometimes when Damian paused in his work, he would see Eusebio walking under the trees, beating himself with his knots and crying, "Mea culpa, mea culpa." One morning, as Damian dug in the ditch at one of the new missions, he noticed Eusebio sitting on a log striking himself. "Really, you're not required to punish yourself that way." "I'm vain," the young friar mumbled, "far too proud of the high position to which God has promoted me." And he struck himself again. "Stop it. If God did the promoting, are you never vainglorious?" "I have little to be vain about. At this mission, Fray Domingo saves the souls. I dig the ditches." "But is your mind never troubled? On the night I was assigned to Béjar, I cried, 'I have sin upon me. I am unworthy to be a shepherd.'" "What changed your mind?" "Work." "But the great battles of faith." This last word seemed to animate Damian, for he put down his shovel and climbed from the irrigation ditch to take his place beside the young friar. "I take great solace from the epistle of James," he said, quoting haphazardly as his memory allowed, "from the startling second chapter which gave Protestant rigorists so much trouble. What does it profit if a man say he has faith but has not works? Can faith save him? Faith, if it has not works, is dead, being alone. You see, then, that by works a man is justified, and not by faith only. For as the body without the Spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. The young man stared at him, but Damian merely kicked at the earth as he said, I know that I am lesser than Domingo, who does the work of God, but I find comfort in doing the work of man. Domingo builds castles in heaven. I build adobe huts here on earth. And I do believe that God sometimes wants both. You never lash yourself? In the morning, I'm too hopeful that on this day I shall be permitted to accomplish something good. At night, I'm too conscious of another failure. Is Domingo really a holy man? He's a good man, and sometimes that's better. His goodness, what does it consist of? He brings happiness in his sack wherever he goes. Was he not rebuked for lewd dancing? Damian ignored this painful charge, shifting the emphasis. From our ranch, he attempts to bring peace to the Apache. I'd be terrified to move anywhere near them. Have you converted any Indians, Eusebio? One, a very old man about to die. He sent his wife running for me, and when I reached him, he said with a smile, Now. And 5 minutes later, he was dead, still smiling. With your prayers, Eusebio, you saved one man. With his songs and his courage, Domingo may save an entire tribe, thousands of Apache living at last in peace, a glory to the goodness of God. I would be afraid to try, Eusebio said, rising and whipping himself again, while Fray Damian climbed back into the ditch, determined to help bring water to Mission San Juan Capistrano. Hernando Cortes had completed his conquest of the Valley of Mexico in 1521, which meant that by 1730 the Spaniards had controlled the country for 209 years. And while it is true that they had constructed on Indian foundations a chain of glowing cities like Puebla, Oaxaca, Guanajuato, Zacatecas, and the charming settlement at Saltillo, they had not accomplished much in remote areas like Tejas. In 1730, Besar, the leading town, contained a population of some 200 Spaniards and Mexicans, only 14 of which were civilians not associated with either the military or the friars at the missions. But now, the letter which Father Espejo had sent to Spain, requesting that true-born Spanish settlers be dispatched to Tejas to build a civilian community, reached the king, who had for some years been contemplating just such a solution to his problems in northern Mexico. In my opinion, we can never secure a frontier province like Tejas until we populate it with trusted men and women of pure Spanish blood, preferably those born in Spain or the Canaries. I advocate sending over a large number of farmers direct from Spain, or such persons already in Cuba. But even though he was an absolute monarch with exceptional powers, he had been unable to move his conservative bureaucracy from their cautious ways, so that the intervening years had seen nothing accomplished in the populating of Tejas. Now, with this new proposal before him, he confronted his ministers and said, The time has come. How about those recalcitrants in the Canaries? And thus he initiated an intricate series of movements, which would eventually bring to Tejas its earliest formal colony of civilian settlers. The Canary Islands lay in the Atlantic Ocean, far removed from Spain and opposite the coastline of Morocco. The islands had been populated centuries earlier by a dark-skinned people from the mainland of Africa, but in time they were conquered by Spain and brought into the bosom of Spanish religion and culture. They were Spaniards, but of a different caste. The Canaries consisted of 7 major islands, none large, and of these, the poorest in material goods, but the most stubborn in resisting authority, was Lanzarote, the one nearest Africa. By a curious chance, it rested on approximately the same parallel of latitude as Béjar, 29 degrees, 30 minutes. So that in making the move to Tejas, these Canary Islanders would be leaping, as it were, some 5,800 miles due west to a somewhat comparable climate. The king, in suggesting that the Tejas settlers be drawn from the Canaries, had Lanzarote specifically in mind, for he had recently received a confidential report regarding these unfortunate islanders. I know the people of Lanzarote occupy an island with miserably poor soil, but they have never shown the slightest interest in farming, or even in properly tending their scrawny sheep and goats. While we all know that the people of the Canaries are generally illiterate, those of Lanzarote are by far the most ignorant. And although our government gives them royal aid, they consistently eat more than they produce. Never have they contributed in any way to the social or economic advancement of our kingdom, and I see no hope for improvement in the future. I recommend that the Crown transplant a number of Lanzarote families to Tejas, where under changed conditions they might, under pressure, learn to become useful citizens. At least we should give my recommendation a trial. To this proposal the king gave hearty approval, and steps were taken to deposit a group of Lanzarote families at the doorstep of the Mission Santa Teresa in Béjar. For the king's command to take effect, his officials had to convince the political leader of Lanzarote that the idea was prudent, and now they were thrown up against one of the wiliest, most contentious, arrogant, conniving, and headstrong men of that time. He was Juan Leal Goras, and according to traditional Spanish custom, he should have been called Leal, his father's name, but he stubbornly insisted that his name was Goras, and so he was known. Now in his 50s, he had 5 children and 1 eye, having lost the other in an argument with a mule. Obstinately, he refused to wear a patch over the missing eye, and with moisture trickling down his cheek, pointed the gaping hole offensively at anyone with whom he spoke. He was illiterate, a deficiency which did not prevent him from becoming the most litigious man in the Canaries. He initiated lawsuits against everyone, priest, king's official, neighbor with a goat, the sea captain of a little ship plying between the islands, and even when he won, he enjoyed prolonging the hearings in hopes of gaining a mite more advantage. Even before he and the other 53 islanders boarded the ship that would carry them to Mexico, Goras was shouting suggestions as to how their accommodations might be improved, and when the captain snarled, "Go to hell," Goras threatened a lawsuit. But on the 20th of March, 1730, the rickety craft set sail, and next morning, after a rough passage, his people landed at Santa Cruz on the main island of Tenerife, where they picked up a few additional immigrants. With inadequate food supplies, they then sailed for Cuba, a difficult crossing of 45 days of heat and seasickness. At one point, the captain, driven almost crazy by the torrent of suggestions from Goras, cried, "Put that man in chains!" And the would-be admiral crossed the Atlantic, bound to 2 huge grinding stones intended for the first grain mill in Tejas. The settlers wasted 2 months in Cuba, then spent 10 steamy days sailing to Veracruz, where on the 19th of July a horrendous epidemic of el vomito prostrated most of them and killed several. They left Veracruz joyously on the 1st of August, headed for the great volcanoes that marked the backbone of Mexico, and they were grateful to reach higher land where el vomito did not flourish. But now they had an equally grave problem. The 2 huge millstones were gifts to the islanders from the king himself. "The crown will support you with your every need, clothes, food, utensils, money, until your first crop comes in." so the stones had sentimental as well as practical value, but they were so large that the oxen drawing them began to die. By the time the islanders reached the foothills of the volcano at Orizaba, it was obvious that hauling the stupendous things was no longer practical. Nevertheless, Goras bellowed, "If the king gave us the stones, we keep them with us." But when more oxen died, even Goras had to agree that the stones should be abandoned until officials in Veracruz could recover them. After 27 painful days, the islanders entered that majestic valley of Mexico, one of the wonders of the world, guarded by the volcanoes Popocatépetl and Iztaccíhuatl, garlanded in flowers and protected by one of heaven's bluest skies. There at the center stood the splendid capital itself, with its university, its printing houses, its grand eating places, and stately mansions. To see Mexico City, after the bucolic simplicity of the Canaries, was an adventure in empire, and Goras told his people, "We'll make Tejas like this, an example to the world." But a muleteer who had once led his animals to Saltillo warned, "I doubt it'll be the same." For almost 3 months, Goras and his islanders languished in the environs of the great city. A few of them, including his own wife, died. Young people contracted marriages. Worn-out horses were exchanged at the king's expense, as promised. And some of the islanders, including Goras, began to think that they should remain in these pleasant surroundings rather than head for Tejas. But the king's orders were that they must move on to Béjar. And so, on the 15th of November, 1730, they resumed their pilgrimage, reaching Saltillo in mid-December, and resting in that lovely town with its salubrious breezes and good food until the end of January, 1731. More people died, children were born, more horses collapsed from exhaustion, and on the 7th of March the surviving islanders reached the Medina, some distance east of where Fray Domingo had his profitable ranch. Looking across its narrow waters into Tejas, they were appalled by what they saw. A continuation of the sea of grass, more mesquite, never a hill, not a single habitation, only an occasional wild horse or a strayed cow with enormous horns. "Oh, God," Goras cried when he saw their new home through his one good eye, "is this Tejas?" He was encouraged, however, by a soldier accompanying the group, who assured him, "At Béjar, where the missions are, everything is better. They have gardens there and food enough to share." On the 9th of March, 1731, Goras led his islanders to the gates of the Misión Santa Teresa, where they were rapturously greeted by a tall, thin friar. "Settlers at last! My name is Fray Damián, and everything within this mission is at your service, for God has delivered you safely to this destination." The friar embraced Juan Leal and the other men, pressed the women's hands, and fought back tears when he saw the emaciated children. "Fray Domingo," he called, "do bring these children some sugar squares." Then he turned to the group and said in a strong, quiet voice, "Let us kneel and give thanks that your long journey is completed." As the little congregation knelt inside the mission gates, he prayed. But Goras, counting the days by the system he kept in his mind, did not, for he was thinking, "The 20th of March last year to the 9th of March this. That's 355 days, and for this?" If Fray Damián had previously thought he'd known trouble with his Indians and soldiers, he was forced to come up with a new definition of that word where the islanders were concerned. Because, within a few weeks, Goras was threatening to bring lawsuits against Damián for failing to provide a suitable place for the Lanzarote people, against Fray Domingo for not carrying out the king's promise that they would be taken care of in these early days, and against Captain Saldaña for malfeasances too numerous to specify. Since none of the islanders could write, and since he knew the complaints had to be made on the proper stamped paper, he badgered Damián de Saldaña to document the charges against his brother Alvaro de Saldaña, and vice versa. In fact, so many garbled reports reached Zacatecas that the commandant there roared one morning, "What in hell is going on up there in Béjar?" And he organized an inspection tour, which he himself led. He learned that the major grievance was one that had surfaced in all parts of northern Mexico. Who controlled the water? The six missions, including Fray Damián's, argued with some reason that since they had established irrigation rights on the San Antonio, a limited stream at best, it would be illegal and against the interests of the Crown for the Canary Islanders to build their own dam and siphon off an undue share of the river. But Goras argued brilliantly. Surely the king did not intend that his loyal servants be brought here and set down in a wilderness with no water. And he pointed out that the six missions, even with the Presidio thrown in, housed fewer Spaniards, real Spaniards, that is, than his new village of San Fernando. At this, one of the soldiers asked, "And when have Canary Islanders been considered real Spaniards?" Goras challenged him on the spot. "A duel. Any weapons you like. Our honor has been abused." He was now engaged in five distinct lawsuits. But the islanders still had no stone houses, no garden plots, no horses, and worst of all, no water. This was an intolerable situation, and Fray Damián knew it. One night, after the most acrimonious confrontation, in which the islanders charged the Saldaña brothers with treason to begin with, and thievery and lechery as tempers grew, Damián consulted with Fray Domingo. "Surely, in the interests of God, we must do something to resolve this bitterness." Domingo started to laugh. "Do you remember, Damián, how we sat here one night just like this, and you told me in your solemn way, 'Domingo, Tejas will never function properly until we import real Spaniards here to establish standards?' Well, now you have your Spaniards. Are you happy about it?" "I had not expected such Spaniards," Damián replied. But the two friars decided on their own to take those Christian steps which any man of good conscience would feel forced to take, regardless of what course the Presidio or the other missions might follow. "We must share our water," Damián said, "and the richness of our land." Before dawn, Domingo and three Indians drove out to the ranch with wagons to be filled with produce and spare tools. Cows, goats, and sheep were rounded up, and then the men slept for a few hours. But at sunset, they started back to where the Canary Islanders needed help. In the meantime, Damián and Garza, working by starlight, traced out a route whereby an irrigation ditch could be led along the crest of hills in such a way that water could be brought from the San Antonio directly onto the fields of the islanders, avoiding the necessity for a costly aqueduct like the one another of the missions would be required to build. But when Goras saw the run of the proposed ditch, he objected strenuously. "My fields are over there. The ditch should run here, and if it doesn't, I shall bring a lawsuit to alter it."